Well, we know all the dogs are awake in the neighborhood. World AIDS Day is this Saturday, December 1st. This will be the 30th anniversary for World AIDS Day, and that's what our program is about today. Hi, and welcome to The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. We always welcome your comments and questions at TFS at WSHU.org. Call us at 833-CALL-TFS. That's 833-225-5837. And check out our Twitter page at Full Story WSHU. There was a time before AIDS and HIV, and you have to be of a certain age to actually remember this, but AIDS changed everything. I remember driving on the Merritt Parkway, going to CPTV in Hartford, when we heard about the planes hitting the towers on 9/11. I looked at my associate producer and I said, "Your life just changed forever." And that's what AIDS did. It changed everything. Joining us for our first segment are John Higney, CEO of the Long Island Association for AIDS Care, and Jane Wells, the grant coordinator for the Long Island Association for AIDS Care. John, Jane, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It's good to join you.
Thank you.
My first question is, do you feel a bit frustrated? Because it seems the only time I hear anyone talk about HIV or AIDS anymore is around World AIDS Day. Is my perception off?
Not really. I think you're correct. I think when in 1997, when protease inhibitors were introduced and it really people began to see light at the end of the tunnel, I think prematurely people said, this is solved and we can move on to other things. I wish things could be solved so easily. I understand why. I think a lot of people were struggling for years with fear caring for other people, caring for themselves, and they just wanted relief. But you're right. I think they, AIDS as a concern fell off the agenda for a lot of people.
Jane, do you see that?
I do, and I also think that the questions now are much more complex. It is not as clear cut. Yes, we have medications, we have methods to help, and people can live happy and healthy lives longer. However, we still have populations that aren't receiving the health care and the education they need and are being impacted.
Let me back
up. When you look at some of the national statistics, Ron, the statistics for 2016 from the CDC is 250,000 Hispanics are living with HIV, and only 50% have achieved viral suppression. By viral suppression, I mean no detectable virus, which of course means that they are in a good place, and they also are not in any position to infect anyone else. But that's a frightening number. We're seeing, particular difficulties with people of color, young men in particular, young gay and bisexual men, even men who have sex with men who don't identify as gay. We're seeing an increase in HIV infection among that group, while you're not seeing an increase nationally across the board.
And is this particular to Long Island?
No. This is true nationally.
Well, what's interesting, though, about Long Island, if you look at the data, with Cuomo's initiative of eradicating AIDS by 2020, we do see a decrease in HIV statewide. However, there was a very interesting article in Newsday in April of 2018 where Northwell had been creating these heat maps where they identified these hot spots for HIV. And one thing the conclusion they made is that island-wide, there's an estimate of 1,000 people who probably are infected with the disease and don't know it, And while the epidemic may be decreasing statewide, it's still expanding, perhaps at a slower rate, therefore not fewer, but more people are living with HIV on Long Island as opposed to the state, New York State as a whole. I found that alarming.
When you say that Governor Cuomo's initiative is to eradicate it by 2020, that doesn't mean a zero number of cases. That only brings it down to a certain number, right?
Well, I think he is aware. Certainly, we support the governor's goals here. And I think he's aware of two things that are very important. First of all, it's now possible with medications to achieve near viral suppression in an individual who's in treatment and is adherent to that treatment. And that's extremely important because that means they, if they're faithful to their medication regimen, they can live more or less a normal life and they're not going to be able to infect other people. He also is aware that there are now prevention strategies, namely PrEP, which is a pre-exposure prophylaxis, as well as increased emphasis on safer sex, condom use, not sharing needles. But there's a real possibility of stopping HIV seroconversion. Those two things together, the possibility of achieving viral suppression in people who are HIV positive and the possibility of keeping people from getting HIV in the first place, that I think is part of his thinking on this. I mean, because if we can achieve viral suppression in more people, reduce the pool of people who can spread the infection, then it's possible really to look at a vastly reduced problem. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't be vigilant. I think that's always extremely important because we're talking about viruses and we're talking about human nature and we're talking about sexually transmitted diseases here. I don't think the governor for a minute means that you stop being vigilant. But I think he's optimistic because, as Jane said, the picture's changed in the past years, and that's important.
And I found his initiative to be bold and hopeful, and he's continuing to shed the light by creating this initiative, looking forward to 2020, to setting goals. It isn't falling off the face of the map. We're looking at HIV. We're continuing to look at it. The numbers are hopeful in terms of statewide. I just found I was just interested in the disparity between those numbers and perhaps the numbers we see on Long Island.
Jane is involved in, the agency is involved in some very specific programs to really address this issue, particularly among people of color and young men who have sex with men. I mean, the CDC in particular funds one of our programs and geared to one of the areas we feel is most at risk and people who are most at risk. And so we're not just in general applauding the governor. We're also taking very, very specific targeted steps to address the problems where we see them.
And how do you target this one group or particular groups to change that risky behavior? How do you reach them?
That is a very good question, because the CDC has identified this population that we're talking about as, quote, hard to reach, which is why it's so important that we work on this initiative. This is a group of young men. We say, the grant says, men who have sex with men of color, and they are 16 to 29. Well, that may seem like a very narrow group of people, but it's very diverse. It is not homogeneous, that group. So if you look at the ages from, say, 16 to 19, developmentally speaking, those men are at a very different point than perhaps men who are 21 to 29. So if we are going to reach these men, and we are really moving in that direction, we're doing some good work, we have to target our outreach. We have to diversify our outreach. So one of the initiatives the CDC encouraged, they funded, was this a safe space. We are a mobile outreach, so that means that we're in the field. We're reaching people at schools, you know, colleges. They often have events where we can test, and or people can call us, and we meet them with our mobile van in their homes or wherever is comfortable to them. But the CDC understood we needed a hub and a home base, and they identified Hempstead, which is one of those hot spots where we know there's a high percentage of people likely to have HIV. And so we have a space there now that we developed, and that's a place that we could invite this group to come, have testing, have workshops. There's a component called the Youth Advisory Board.
Jane, I'm going to hold you there for 1 second because we only have 30 seconds left. So I just want to give you the opportunity to give a phone number or a website so people can reach you.
Okay. They could just call us at the Long Island Association for AIDS Care, 631-385-2451. And if they just Google LIAC, they'll see our website.
John Hagney, CEO of the Long Island Association for AIDS Care, and Jane Wells, the grant coordinator for the Long Island Association for AIDS Care. And once again, that phone number is 631-385-2451. John, Jane, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Full Story. When we come back, we'll have Meg Coffey's story. Stay with us. When I was a younger reporter, I worked for Connecticut Public TV. And in the 80s, under the guidance of our program director, Larry Rifkin, we were able to report on a number of different topics which weren't really being covered by the quote-unquote mainstream media. One of the first shows we did was about AIDS and how it was affecting Connecticut. A lot of the information we had at that time and that we aired was wrong because it was new and everyone was trying to understand and figure out what was going on. So the idea behind a program was to try and get the latest information and to speak with some of those who were dealing with the deadly virus. And that brings me to my next guest. As I knew her at the time, she was Meg Coffey, now Meg Smith, and she had been married to John Coffey. Meg and I became friends, but life being what it is, we lost track of each other. But I'm happy to say we reconnected recently, and she's kind enough to join us today. Hi, Meg.
Hey, Ron.
How are you?
I'm very well. Fun to be here, and thank you so much.
You know, I was telling you that it was so many decades ago, but I remember it like it was yesterday. I can still remember sitting in your living room as you told us about your husband, John Coffey.
Mm-hmm.
How did you meet?
Yeah. Well, I'll just tell you, it was 35 years ago. I had to take out my calculator and do the math to be sure I was right. Well, it was actually 33 because he died in 1985. We met in 1979, got involved in a political campaign, and actually in Fairfield County in the 4th Congressional District. Stuart McKinney was the Republican incumbent, and a young Princeton upstart named John Aristotle Phillips decided he was going to brashly run for Congress, having not held an office before. He had just graduated from college a few years prior. And John Coffey was his campaign manager. And I became the press secretary, which was my immersion into the media world, and which I really enjoyed. So John and I worked on the campaign. We fell in love. We got married in 1981. And John was a mild hemophiliac. He had talked about it. I'd experienced with him when he had a bruise, which usually involved, you know, an elbow, a joint, basically knee, elbow, fingers. And the bleeding just would continue. It was internal bleeding. And he would need to go get something called clotting factor, factor 8, which was a godsend for hemophiliacs, developed in the 70s. It extracted the clotting agent of thousands of donors of blood into a tiny concentrate that you would distill with water and inject, and it saved thousands and thousands of hemophiliacs. And that was John's standard operating procedure to get factor VIII when he experienced a bruise or a bleed. And it only happened maybe five times from the time I knew him, so he was that mild. By 1983, when he hit his hand, knew he had to go to the doctor, he'd already read a story in the New York Times about three hemophiliacs being infected with AIDS. It was the first time AIDS had ever crept out of the gay drug IV user category into something else, and he noticed and was very concerned, and in fact refused to take the full dosage that was given to him. He thought it was too much, and he didn't want the factor VIII, but there was nothing else. And he came back from that ER visit and said to me, "I bet I got AIDS." And I, at the time, was very angry at him, and I just rolled my eyes and was like, "Come on. Like, let's not just go all drama here." And that was the blood product that had the HIV virus in it, and it killed him after 2 years.
And this became such big news around here because at that time, everyone just thought of this as the gay disease.
Exactly. We were one of the first heterosexual couples. And, you know, I mean, we know so much more now, but at the time, and as just your previous guests are talking about how we think about AIDS today, and it's just so different. But at the time, I mean, AIDS was bigger than the Ebola virus. I mean, people were terrified. They wouldn't give blood or have blood transfusions, which made no sense. You can give blood very safely. Blood transfusions, that's how Arthur Ashe, I believe, got AIDS and died, was from a transfusion in operation. But hemophiliacs were a particular risk because of that concentrated clotting factor. So one vial of clotting factor was exposing you from anywhere from 10 to 20,000 donors in one little tiny bottle. So naturally, the hemophiliac community was decimated by AIDS. But yeah, when you and I met, I mean, let's put it this way. I was the only person anybody knew who was a female who was dealing with AIDS with her husband, let alone that was an anomaly. We were just so fortunate. We had such a supportive family and supportive friends and good health care. And, you know, that I can say a lot of it was in retrospect. And even then I knew it's like if we weren't white, Anglo-Saxon, preppy, Fairfield County, well-educated people, we probably wouldn't even be getting the kind of attention that we did. And John was a very, very bright, intelligent guy, and he commanded that kind of attention. I mean, he knew how to articulate the issues, to talk about his illness. Doctors were so happy to have somebody who could actually be very specific about what was going on with them. I look back, of course, it was just this crazy point in time, but I was in the vortex.
When you say when you say that you were a young, attractive, white couple from Fairfield County, I mean, that hits it right on the head of the nail because you were so unusual that, and again, this is for people who are of a certain age, the McNeil Air News Hour put you on TV because of this.
Mm-hmm.
Because a couple people like you weren't supposed to get AIDS.
Exactly. And that was, in fact, you know, one of the great, I mean, you look back at experiences that shape you, that shaped me tremendously in terms of a number of levels and dealing with death and hospice care and all those things that, you know, age 29 was life-changing, but also it was really my first understanding of, like, the bias, the positive bias that I had It didn't save my husband, but it certainly, it was very clear that we were an anomaly, and because we were white and because we were, you know, Princeton and Choate Rosemary Hall and all the right schools, and you know, we got so much better attention than so many people, so many young men who were dying in hospitals all around the country, but particularly in New York, where he John was treated, as well as Yale New Haven, and then, you know, on the West Coast, where in those early 80s, that's really where the epicenters of AIDS.
When, let me back up for just one moment here. You got a lot of attention, as you say, because of who you were, and you got treatment because of who you were. But at the same time, from your friends or family or acquaintances, were you shunned in any way because this was so new? Were people scared of you?
There were different isolated experiences that, yes, we tried to rent a place in Southport, and it looked, everything was fine until the wife of the couple kept inquiring about John's medical condition and why, you know, what was wrong. And I kept saying he had a blood disease. And then eventually we had to, you know, she kept asking, and we ended up saying, yes, he had AIDS, and she refused to rent the place to us, which was devastating. We had nowhere to live. And actually, John filed a suit with the Human Rights Commission, the state of Connecticut, which we won, but a hollow victory. And I had coworkers at different times that were like, suddenly there'd be little flare-ups, and suddenly someone was asking, and I realized someone was scared to use my phone, or they'd use my phone at on my desk, and they were suddenly very uncomfortable and nervous. You know, so I was always trying to educate people about, you know, the virus being very fragile and airborne or not airborne and only sexually transmitted through blood, et cetera, et cetera. But it's really hard to not be scared. And but we didn't, you know, we weren't abandoned. A lot of people were literally, you know, kicked out of their houses or their rent, wherever they were living. But yeah, when we couldn't get that apartment, and then we ended up, only because someone's very nice friend who lived in Maine in the summer let us stay in their condo in Fairfield for a couple of months. That was about as close to homeless as I'd ever gotten, and it did not. It was a very difficult time. But, you know, many people had it so much worse.
You and I talked about this years ago, and I feel a little weird bringing it up again, but how was John as the end got closer? What was his mood?
Well, I'm happy to talk about these things. I think it's important to share these things. I mean, John's illness progressed very slowly for the first year, and I'd say first year and a half, and then he started getting sicker. And he did not, he suffered from pneumocystis. That was going to be the thing that would kill him. He didn't have some of the other opportunistic infections that other AIDS patients exhibited, like the Kaposi sarcoma, the skin cancer, and other things. But he, you know, 3 months, this is sad to bring up, but it's part of what happened. 3 months before John's death, my father died out of the blue. And that was just awful. And that is when, after the shock was over, John really declined. And we both agreed that we were not going to pursue any more treatments and trying to do all the stuff that he'd done before. And then it was accepting that death was coming. And that's where Connecticut Hospice was wonderful. And they helped us. We called them again. We were like, I think, the second or third AIDS patient they'd ever had. And it was thanks to the only home health care aide, this is through the VNA and the hospice program, that volunteered to take the case. No one else would come to our house but this wonderful woman, Kat Galbraith of Bridgeport, came and became our home health aide for the 3.5 months that John lived, and that was a huge help. We had a wonderful minister, Stephen Chinlin, from the Southport Church. That was another sort of mainstay. And my godmother was a hospice volunteer, and she was wonderful. So, you know, but John was receding, and clearly it wasn't easy. He hated losing control, and he had to, and that was very difficult. I mean, we had some lovely moments, but his, you know, his final days were pretty tough. And he moved into Connecticut Hospice in Branford for the last 3 weeks of his life.
How old was he when he passed?
He was 30. He had turned 30 the year before, so he was almost 31.
That's so young.
I know. And he was so smart. And he was so politically active, and there were so many things I look at, and I can say that I really thought if John Coffey had lived, he would have probably ended up working in the Democratic National Committee as a as one of the strategists, and I really wonder if our politics might have been changed had he lived. He was a very strong, very smart, and very strategic guy. So... yeah, you know, everybody's life. One life goes out. You wonder, you know, what might have happened if they'd been able to live longer.
You were you were a dynamic couple. I mean, you're still dynamic, but you were a dynamic couple. You really were.
Oh, well, I get. Yeah, I mean, we were, for being as young as we were, our late 20s, we really were into politics, which was pretty unusual, and in Fairfield County. So... I really enjoyed that, and that kind of, that again, also sort of steered me in a direction I probably would have never necessarily gone into the media and communications had I not had those years in the political field. I really loved that. But,
And you told me the other night that life went on for you, and you just celebrated 29 years of marriage?
Yes, I remarried 5 years after John died, and I'm very happily married a wonderful man and I moved up to Vermont. I live outside of Burlington, Vermont now, but all my family's in Connecticut. I get down there very often, but yes, I just had our 29th wedding anniversary, and I've been very, very fortunate. I mean, my life has been wonderful up here, and, you know, there are things that I've done here. Well, I've never forgotten John, obviously, and I've never forgotten what I went through, and it shaped me. I did the hospice training up here, became a hospice volunteer for a while, which I will probably do again in my life.
I forget, I want to just say you're still big time. You are now the director of the Vermont Women's Fund.
Yes. I got a really fun job working on behalf of women and girls here in Vermont, and it's a philanthropic fund that we are helping to change the story and economic outlook for women and girls in our state.
Meg,
so that's been great.
Meg, we have 1 minute left. There are many people who are listening to this program who have loved ones or someone they know with HIV or with AIDS. Mm-hmm. What do you say to them?
Well, you know, I look at chronic illness. It doesn't matter what the illness is, whether it's AIDS or cancer or whatever debilitating disease people suffer with. And, you know, it's a universal, death is universal, but we just don't realize it. And it's really hard to go it alone. Hospice is a wonderful resource. Any kind of support groups are really helpful. I'm sorry that AIDS continues on in our culture. We could cure it. It's going to take a while still, but certainly it shouldn't be forgotten, and we need to, you know, make sure young people understand the risks they're taking with unprotected sex and all the pretend and sharing needles and all the stuff that still transmits this disease. But, you know, you're not alone, and there's a lot more help out there now than there ever was 35 years ago. So there are good people working in the field, and take advantage of it.
Meg Smith, one of the most amazing women I've ever known. Meg, thank you.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
We're going to take a look now at HIV and AIDS in Connecticut. We're going to take a look at the statewide picture. We'll find out what the situation is like in the state's largest city, Bridgeport. Virginia Hanrahan is executive director of the Greater Bridgeport Area Prevention Program. LaToya Tyson is the director of prevention with ACT ACT AIDS Connecticut. Hi, LaToya.
Nice to be here today.
It's great to be here. And I have to say, you made my day when you walked in before, because this is a tough topic to talk about. And I said, hi, LaToya, how are you? And you said, I'm blessed. And I'm like, wow, that just turned my whole day around. That is such a positive attitude.
Awesome.
And I love that. Tell me about ACT.
ACT is an AIDS service organization that serves the greater Hartford area. And we do both direct and indirect services. So we service clients that are HIV positive via case management, transitional living, which are the inmates coming out of prison. We also do some housing things for clients. So we do a lot of, and we also have a wellness center. So we do a lot of things directly with folks that are HIV positive. But we also have our prevention side that addresses education, HIV hep C testing. We also do a syringe exchange program, naloxone. So we do quite a number of things.
How long has ACT been around?
ACT itself is a very small, very young agency. It's about 5 years old, but it is a merger of two agencies that have been around for over 20 years each, AIDS Project Hartford and the Connecticut AIDS Resource Coalition.
And where do you get your funding from?
We get funding from the state.
And has that funding been steady the last number of years? Because the state is obviously going through fiscal turmoil.
Yes.
Are you okay?
As of right now, there's always fluctuation there. And there's always, whenever, you know, the new RFPs come out, there's always this time where we're looking at, oh, everybody's now going for the same funding or, you know, things like that. So funding is always a little bit fickle. Our prevention fundings, fortunately, this year did not get cut at all. But we'll see how that continues to manifest.
Virginia, once again, it's great to have you
here. Thank you for having me.
Is the situation in Bridgeport improving or getting worse? I'm going to ask you to move a little closer to the mic.
Well, it depends on who you're talking to, you know. I mean, we would like to think we're making a big difference. We would like to think that, you know, because we work so much with all types of communities, that, you know, our word is getting out. But we still have three areas that we're really focusing on in Bridgeport, the highest numbers amongst black women, transgender people, and men having sex with men. That's the population that we're the most concerned with. And, you know, very similar to LaToya, we provide syringe exchange, HIV testing services. We do case management. We have an array of services we also work with. Narcan trainings, et cetera. We go out all over the community and work with, you know, any group that wants us.
Is this just in Bridgeport or also some of the surrounding towns?
We consider it Bridgeport and Greater Bridgeport. You know, and if the surrounding towns need us, we're there for them. But they often have their own support systems. But, you know, we have often gone in as an advisory capacity. And the other thing that we are is the lead agency for the Ryan White grant for Bridgeport. And our partners are, let's see, which ones are there? They're Optimist Health Center, Southwest, the Recovery Network Program, LifeBridge, and I'm probably forgetting one. What is the other one? Liberation.
Mm-hmm.
And
But before we jump forward, for those who don't know who Ryan White was, can you explain, please?
He was a young gentleman. He was very young. He was
12.
Like 12.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't quite in his teens yet. He was just into his teens. He contracted AIDS and through no fault of his own, similar to the coffee story.
Mm-hmm.
And he became an activist at a very young age, and so one of our largest federal grants was designed in his name, which is the Ryan White Grant. And so we lead that grant for the city of Bridgeport, and we manage it and help and work with all of our partners so that they can actually do the same kind of work we're doing. We're a community-based organization. We have many other things that we do. We don't provide housing for people with HIV. We provide housing for LGBTQ youth through one of our programs and for young kids who are coming out of foster care. We have that kind of housing. But all of our programs, which are all very diverse, within, we call it GBAP, Greater Bridgeport Area Prevention Program, we would like to think that there's cross-pollination between what goes on in our HIV department and all the other departments in our program.
LaToya, is the situation for HIV and AIDS getting better or worse in Connecticut?
Well, in Connecticut, it's kind of stabilized. Fortunately for us, Connecticut is one of the states that has some of the better resources for folks that are positive and people that are at high risk for HIV. So we still have new infections that are consistently happening, but of course, quite similar to the, was that Rhode Island or Long Island that you were talking
Long
about?
Long Island.
Okay. So quite similar to the folks in Long Island, Connecticut, the health commissioner has commissioned us to a Getting to Zero initiative. And Getting to Zero for us in this state means getting to zero new HIV infections, zero HIV-related deaths, and zero HIV-related stigma.
That's very ambitious.
Extremely ambitious. Extremely.
How likely is it that that would actually happen? And if it does, do you have a date in mind?
We are shooting for 2020.
Just like New York State.
Just like New York State. To see progressive change, true progressive change in that direction. In terms of getting to zero completely, we don't quite have a date for, because we do realize that things like stigma are so heavily rooted into our society and into the community of HIV that, and of course, when you break down the different populations, the stigma can be even heavier and on a much different level. So we do realize that that's going to take a lot of chipping away at, but we are very hopeful.
One of the things that our program is doing is that our deputy director, her name's Nancy Kingwood, she is involved with the commission and was appointed to the commission. And they have come up with a group of policies that are going to be helpful in sort of pulling this whole thing together so that we can really combat it better.
Well, their recommendations.
And they're coming out. A lot of them have been rolling off the hot presses.
Mm-hmm.
But their recommendations for treatment, recommendations for interaction with people. And as LaToya was saying, our biggest issue is stigma and trauma. And
still to this day,
absolutely.
Even after
yes.
what we're hearing from
yes.
Meg and okay.
Yeah. No. It depends on where you're from. It depends on what your experience has been. People don't want to admit to people around them or even to themselves that they could possibly be infected and it's not their fault.
Mm-hmm.
And so we work a lot with various communities and including the faith community, where we can get folks to talk and to share their experiences and everything else. It's about education, but it's bigger than that. So GBAP is a trauma informed organization, I think, which we encourage other groups to be.
You know, when we talk about stigma, Ron, one of the big things that's a huge factor is how it's exacerbated by society and the different type of language that we use, right? And so HIV, people tend to attach a morality to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Especially when we talk about, you know, are you at fault? Did you do something to catch this? Did you, you know, invite this on yourself because of behaviors? And the truth of the matter is that HIV doesn't give a flying rats about that whatsoever. It is an organism just like any other organism that wants to live, grow, thrive, and multiply. And it just needs specific conditions favorable for its transmission. So when people attach a morality to HIV, that deters people from having conversations that are extremely important with their potential sexual partners, with people that they may be sharing needles with providers about what some of their specific behaviors are. Because when you look at somebody and you think, oh, well, you brought this on yourself, or, well, if you hadn't been doing X, Y, and Z, this wouldn't have happened to you, you will shut someone off from talking, you know? So stigma is not just within the communities, which is there, and it's really strong and very heavy, but it also comes from society as a whole and how we all look at and address HIV.
In the early days of this epidemic, I was working in Danbury with a public health department, and I ran part of the AIDS program there, and it was all gay focused. And it was, you know, there was such stigma around that, but the carryover from it is that many people still think of it. I know it sounds bizarre, mm-hmm. but they still think of it as a gay disease.
As a gay disease,
so,
which is what I was saying before.
So, for instance, what LaToya was saying, because, you know, I have a hard time dialoguing here in the air by myself, so I'll bring you into my conversation.
Of course.
But the thing is that when we think about poverty, mm-hmm. there's shame around poverty.
Yes.
If you're poor, it's because you've done something wrong.
Exactly.
Right.
If you look at media...
How come you didn't work 7 days a week?
How come
exactly.
you are poor? You must be poor because you did something wrong. And if you're losing your house, it's because you did something wrong. Well, mm-hmm. we know that, you know, the economy, particularly in Connecticut, is one of the harshest places. You know, it's hard to live here for the average person.
Just let me reintroduce you for 1 second, in case you're just joining us, you're listening to The Full Story. That is Virginia Hanrahan, who is the executive director of the Greater Bridgeport Area Prevention Program, and LaToya Tyson is with us, the director of prevention with ACT, A-C-T, AIDS Connecticut. LaToya, kids nowadays, have they changed their behavior enough where you feel optimistic for the future?
Yes and no.
Okay.
So I'll do the no first. No, because children... young people tend to think that they are invincible. Mm-hmm. They don't see or envision something bad happening to me. I'm too young for that. I've got a lot of life to live.
The most dangerous thing in the world is a teenage boy.
So they tend to take risks unnecessarily. But on the flip side, yes, because they are becoming way more educated. They are knowing about things like PrEP, which is a medication that can help prevent HIV from actually infecting someone who's been, you know, exposed to it. They know stuff about U equals U, meaning undetectable equals untransmittable. Not having a lot of virus in the system means you are no longer infectious if you're HIV positive. They're learning about PEP, which you can take after you've been exposed to prevent infection. So they tend to be more open to teaching and to learning about ways of prevention. Unfortunately, however, they weren't around in the 80s. Mm. They don't know what that was like. They have no inclination of watching dozens and dozens of your friends die every week, every month, several months out of the year, you know? So they have no concept of the true dangers that also mm-hmm. still lie with HIV. Yes, now it's a manageable chronic infection, but because they don't have that urgency, that sense of urgency, oh, well, if I catch HIV, I can just take a pill. And that's kind of the mindset.
We do human sexuality education in the schools. That's one of our mandates. And we have a team that goes out and gives a whole curriculum to the middle schoolers and high school students also. And we experience the same thing. There's an invincibility. You know, they know they have the information. They know what can happen, but they haven't seen it happen. They don't remember it.
Yeah, but isn't that the way we all were at that
we
age?
We all were. And the other thing is, you know, we know a condom is one of your best friends. But as much as our young people know, they're not so quick to use a condom. And then there's almost an embarrassment around it. I mean, because we may know about our bodies. We may know. All of the wonderful things that it can do. But when we get right down to it, there's still shyness and shame and, you know, I want to give my partner what they want, so I won't use a condom. And, you know, it's what we talk about in a lot of our meetings. you know, at GBAP, is that how do you get people to see these tools as necessary and even, I want to say, fun?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we carry every color of the rainbow, but that doesn't necessarily mean people are going to use them.
Well, that's why we give people choices.
Yeah, we give them lots of choices.
Yes, you have the condoms. You have the male condoms. You have the female condoms. You have the dental dam. You have the finger condoms. But you also go into, that's why we also talk about treatment as prevention. Mm-hmm. We talk about you equals you and people not being infectious when they are undetectable. We also talk about PrEP. We talk about those things also in the context of prevention, because for those that don't like using condoms, they tend not to. Mm. And you can talk to your blue in the face. Mm. They know 100% if I use these, I'll stay protected. But if they really don't like them for whatever their reason is, they tend not to use them. Mm. So I've learned that if I give options and give them the entire smorgasbord of these are all of the ways that you can stay protected, at least they'll choose one.
Mm-hmm.
And I would rather them choose one of those options than none of them at all.
And we do that also. We talk about everything that you can do to protect yourself.
We have about one and a half minutes left.
Yep.
Give us the outlook, quick outlook for the next few years. What would you like to see happen? And is there any information about contacting you that you would like to have our audience know?
So very quickly, the Getting to Zero, as Virginia mentioned, a campaign, we are focusing and prioritizing Black women, transgender individuals, and men who have sex with men. I also like to mention the fact that the our 61 and over have 25% of new infections every year. So like the youth, they're also not protecting themselves, and to make sure that everyone is actually getting educated. AIDS Connecticut is located in Hartford. We are at 110 Bartholomew Avenue on the third floor. We provide, again, the free HIV and Hep C testing, as well as counseling and condoms of all kinds. Our phone number is 860-247-2437.
Virginia?
The prognosis is good. We are striving to get to zero. That is what we're doing. And the most important thing we're doing is making sure that people out there know they have someone to talk to. And our phone number is 203-366-8255. And anytime you call, there'll be someone to talk to you.
Some days I just get to do a show with the most amazing people. Thank you both.
Thank you for having me.
LaToya Tyson, Virginia Hanrahan.
Thank you.
My thanks to our other guests. That's it for our show today. Anna Lopez is the producer. Terry Sheridan, news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to all of you for being part of the full story.